Vaccines have been stirring debate and controversy ever since an English country doctor named Edward Jenner scraped pus from a milkmaid's cowpox blister into the arm of his gardener's 8-year-old son. And that was in 1796. Nothing, however, could have prepared us for the ongoing legal and political Donnybrook sparked by efforts to curb COVID-19. Hi, I'm John Schwannis, and on this edition of Indiana Lawmakers, we'll look at how that conflict is playing out in the Hoosier State. Don't go away. Indiana Lawmakers, from the State House to your house. The COVID-19 pandemic started out as a potentially deadly fight between the human immune system and a novel virus known formally as severe acute respiratory syndrome, coronavirus 2. For better or worse, however, it quickly evolved, or mutated as the doctors might say, into a pitched battle between states, between political parties, between economic sectors, between branches of government, and between fundamental beliefs about an individual's role in society. Joining me to make sense of it all are Republican Representative Matt Lehman of Bern, Representative Ryan Hatfield, an Evansville Democrat, Kevin Brenniger, President and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Brian Tabor, President of the Indiana Hospital Association. Thank you all for being here for this important discussion. I wonder if we could start with something I observed last week when I was doing close to 100 interviews, individual interviews with members of the General Assembly as part of a project with IPBS. The first question was pretty much the same for everybody. What's on the minds of folks in your district? And the vast majority said COVID. It was the answers to the second or the follow-up question that I found really revealing, and that is half the people said, yeah, they're concerned about, will they get sick? How do they stay out of the hospital? Where do they get test kits? How can they get tested? Are their kids going to be out of school? If so, who's going to take care of child care? The other half said, yeah, my constituents are concerned about an assault on personal liberty and an encroachment on personal liberty. Clearly spelled out the dichotomy of views. I wonder if we could go around the panel, and we'll start, Matt Lehman, with you. Give me how you view COVID generally, personally and through the eyes of, in this case, your constituents, and when we get to the association presidents, we'll substitute members for constituents. Matt Lehman.
All right. Well, thank you, John. Thanks for having us on today. I would say that from my perspective, and I come from a very rural area of Indiana, Northeast Indiana, and it began like everybody else in this. We just didn't know what the future held. We went through the process of, you know, we shut down, we did the masking, we did all that. The vaccine came along, and you know, I'm vaccinated. I think it's a good thing to do. And we saw people getting vaccinated. And then we kind of, I'd say in the last probably year, at least the last 6 or 8 months, is my district has been, quote, back to normal. I mean, this really has not been an issue. When I go to town meetings or I see people at the grocery store or at church, their issues are more around, okay, tell me about your kind of this tax cut thing. How's that going to affect me? And let's talk about, you know, why is my kids still having to wear masks at school? So COVID weaves into all this, but I think this idea that that's at the top of the people's list in my district is it's starting to move down that list.
All right. Ryan Hatfield, same question, folks in Evansville.
Yeah, sure. You know, COVID-19 started out, I think, as Matt described, as very worrisome, and we saw a number spike in hospital beds be a concern. And then I think we started to see some relief as people got vaccinated. But now that we've kind of hit that number of vaccinations where we're starting to see it tail off and we see numbers start to come back up, you know, I represent two major hospitals. And I can tell you that while the grocery stores are filled back up and there are folks wearing masks and doing the right things and that in some ways life has gotten back to normal, the folks who work in those hospitals can tell you life has not gotten back to normal, that numbers are continue to increase, beds are still a concern, and they're very concerned about their well-being and their health. And I'll add, primarily around their children and those who can get vaccinated or children under 5 who cannot get vaccinated, who are going to school and around a large number of other kids every single day, that what we know by the numbers, most of whom are not vaccinated. And it's a concern. And then once those kids are sent home, whether they're sick or someone else in the classroom is sick, that involves employment problems, childcare problems, and it really is disrupting not only our children's daily lives, but they're parents who are unable to get to work because of childcare issues. And so it's still a strain in Evansville, and I think throughout the state.
Let's continue around. Kevin Brenniger.
Well, what we're seeing is employers are struggling with the uptick in the cases. They have a lot of people out with COVID or quarantine. I have one member that's got retail stores all around the state and is having to reduce hours and in some cases close stores for periods of time because they just don't have the staff. So, yes, we're trying to function in many ways as normal, but there's this dark cloud of COVID, particularly with the upspike in the uptick in the Omicron variant. I know in our shop, you know, here at the chamber, I've got 10% of my employees out with COVID, one of them very severely. And, you know, we're having to adjust and make do with fewer people and not have access to some of the expertise that we normally have. And so it is, and then, you know, Brian can talk about the hospitals, but we know they're stretched to the max, and it's with many of those are with people that aren't in their workplace. And so it's contributing to supply chain issues and, quite frankly, contributing to the inflation that we're seeing.
Brian Tabor, Indiana Hospital Association.
Well, you know, I think I understand the desire of, you know, the constituents that Representative Lehman talked about. You know, I share the same sentiments of that desire to return to normalcy, very much so for, you know, my kids and school and everything. They want to pursue their athletics and all that. I wish it weren't still hanging around. But as Representative Hatfield said, if you look within the four walls of our hospitals across the state, they are in an emergency state. It is at a crisis level in terms of our staffing, the number of patients that we're treating where we don't have a normal bed. I was visiting some hospitals just last week up in northern Indiana, and we're treating patients in hallways. Hundreds of patients across the state are waiting for a bed in the emergency room, and we're just not able to care for patients in the way that we want. And that's not just patients with COVID. It's affecting patients that need care for all kinds of conditions. And so we're just not there yet. The system is under extreme strain right now, and I hope that it will be relieved soon as this maybe next wave kind of subsides. But right now, things are very precarious.
And Brian, just to follow up, this week did bring yet another record, right, in terms of the number of patients admitted to Indiana's hospitals with COVID. Is that correct? It seems that every week brings a new. By the time people watch this for the eighth time, and a lot of people, I'm sure watch it 10 times, it'll be up at maybe another record next week. Is that what you're seeing continuing in those numbers?
We set a record last week for the highest number of patients with COVID in the hospital. But what's really concerning us is we also have reached a record for the total number of patients. We're also seeing that, you know, throughout the pandemic, Hoosier's health has declined for various reasons. Maybe care was put off because something had to be rescheduled or folks were afraid to interact with the system. We're seeing in our emergency rooms a lot of instances of behavioral health problems, I think. So it's not just COVID, but COVID is clearly taking up all the capacity that's built into the system. So we don't just have a crisis of COVID patients right now. We have a crisis of total patients, and COVID is a huge driver of that and is really taking up all that capacity.
Well, we've seen the landscape on this issue, so let's dive into what the lawmakers in our state house are hoping to do about it. And that takes us back to Matt Lehman. The number one priority for Republicans in the House, your caucus, Matt Lehman, and you are the floor majority floor leader, so you have you're in lockstep with that group, certainly, is your bill, House Bill 1001, and that number bears significance. That means it's the top priority, if anyone doubted. To end the governor's emergency health order and try to return in the workplace, which your bill deals also with, as quickly and as seamlessly as possible. Tell us what lurks behind 1001, what your motivation is, and what you hope to accomplish.
Well, 1001 is the genesis of 1001 really comes out of announcements in September by the Biden administration that there was going to be a mandate on all businesses, and then followed by, you know, CMS, all healthcare, et cetera. The response to that was, is we began to get, I began to get a lot of calls from people who said, I don't know what the future holds. And I've, you know, I'm a long-term employee, and my employer's telling me that we are, I am going to be dismissed if I don't get the vaccination. I'm young. I've talked to my, you know, maybe my OBGYN who has said, you know, be cautious. We just don't know what this might do. And so I think with that doubt, they began to look to say, is there anything you can do that protects us? And, you know, we have federal guidelines that do that. But we said, we need to probably step up and have something that sends a message that says we are going to defend. There's a place between where the employer, it's their business. They have a right to do what they want to do. And so it's there, as you mentioned in the beginning, this, John, there was extremes on this. You know, there were many, we had many amendments on this that were to just simply ban all mandates, you know, and that's not where you want to go with this. At the same time, there has to be some employee rights. And so this was trying to find that narrow space of doing that. And what this does not do, and where the debate, if you followed the 14 hours of debate back in November and December, it became, you know, is the vaccine effective? Is the vaccine safe? Is the vaccine that, this has nothing to do with the vaccine. This has to do with workers who are saying, look, I've had 13 months to decide whether or not I want to get the vaccine, and I've chosen not to. And I want to take what I think is my right, which is my religious exemption, my medical exemption, my immunity exemption, which we're now seeing, you know, the immunity numbers. We've had doctors say that natural immunity, you know, is in some cases better than the vaccine. And then we put in the piece that we revolved around testing, which is what in the original OSHA mandate, which has now been struck down by the courts. But it really, we were trying to just thread that needle, you might say, of protection for the employee. And that's simply what this is. The state of emergency piece, I think, was a little bit more simple. And that is, it was just saying, look, there's these parts around Medicaid. I think Ryan brought up, you know, that some of the vaccines on younger children is if a parent wants to do that, we're going to continue to allow that to happen in vaccine clinics. We have people now who are on Medicaid and we're capturing those enhanced funds. We want to continue that. And that's what was, that was really the only thing keeping us in that state of emergency. So that part of that bill is to bring that to an end and then move forward.
And there, and we should point out, there's a Senate bill that would do just the latter half of what you talked about, ending right. So we'll see on the other side which survives and which falls by the wayside. What's wrong with the concept and the proposal that Matt Lehman just described, Ryan Hatfield? You voted against it along with 37, other people. The vote this week, by the way, for those keeping score, was 58-37, I believe it passed. What's wrong with the bill?
Well, we just heard the three primary reasons for the bill, and I'll work backwards. The third reason provided was that the emergency orders, that the legislator wanted more input on the emergency orders. The House Republican attack on this governor is outstanding to me. It's really disconcerting that they have such little faith in this governor, and perhaps we need to address that. About if there are so many House Republicans who have concerns about the governor's ability to govern, perhaps we need to have that conversation. The second reason provided was that employers and that we needed to save these jobs. We have the organization that represents the largest number of jobs in the state, in the Indiana Chamber, opposing this legislation, saying it's a bad idea. And then first, that the outset of the bill was about the Biden administration's mandates. Well, we got a ruling on that this week, and the Supreme Court overturned those mandates in large part. All the OSHA regulations are now gone due to the Supreme Court ruling. And so I'm glad to hear that if that's the purpose of the bill, we now can withdraw the bill. And I expect that the leader will probably withdraw it now that the Supreme Court has ruled that those mandates are no longer in effect. And so, you know, I think that for all three reasons, Hoosiers deserve better, and the bill is not the right step to protect us.
And I guess the Supreme Court, though, they said any business over 100 people, which is what the Biden administration's rule applied to, wouldn't be forced to offer mandates. The distinction here, I guess, in this bill is that it's about the prerogative of employers, whether they would be barred, the flip side, I guess, be barred from offering the testing. Kevin Brenninger, you're not accustomed, your organization's not accustomed to being at odds with Republicans in the General Assembly. Explain to your members who might have missed a chapter and are scratching their heads what happened here.
Well, our fundamental position is that employers are in the best position to determine what is the best vaccination policy for their employees, their customers, and their patients. And so we don't want the federal government telling us we must mandate, and we don't want the state telling us that the employers are prohibited from having vaccination requirements. Now, we're grateful to Senator or to Representative Lehman that his bill didn't go that far, and that amendments that would have taken it that far were not adopted. But we feel this bill really discourages and makes it more difficult for employers to have vaccination mandates. The federal OSHA rule, which has been halted, said that the employees who refused to get vaccinated would have to be subject to testing every week, and that would not be at the expense of the employer. This bill says that those employers who claim an exemption, that claim an exemption have to be offered testing at no expense to them, which implies at the employer's expense.
Wasn't that amended, though, to provide a mechanism for seeking refunds?
Well, that's what I was about. That was about what I touched on. Now, the amendment was added to allow the employers to be reimbursed, but it was capped off at $50. And for most of the tests that are out there, that's just a partial reimbursement. Plus, you've got to go through all the rigmarole of gathering the data, filing it, and waiting for DWD to reimburse you.
And I think I saw you quoted this week as saying some members might see testing bills as expenses as much as $6 million. So we're not talking a pocket change.
I haven't used that number, but I did have one member that did some back of the envelope calculations and said that within 6 months it would cost them $1.2 million for a company that has 700 employees, of which a little less than half are not vaccinated. The other thing is that the Representative Lehman referenced federal exemptions and procedures. And if our preference would have been that if you want to put an Indiana stake in the ground, that we reference by in our statute Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, rather than create our own set of exemptions. And now employers have to follow two different sets of rules. The other irony in all this is that the hue and cry that Representative Lehman and his caucus members heard predominantly came from healthcare workers, and many in one particular health system that was doing blanket denials of religious exemptions, which is a questionable practice. And my understanding is some of those employees are pursuing litigation under Title VII. But now we've got the Supreme Court has approved the CMS rule. So, you know, the healthcare workers were driving the impetus for this bill in many respects, but now they're still going to have to be subject to vaccinations because of the decision on the CMS regulation.
Okay, Kevin, let's go to Brian Tabor, since he deals with healthcare workers. Again, your employees fall into a different category because the same day the Supreme Court said no to the part of the broad Biden administration mandate, they said, sure. The part that applies to recipients of Medicaid and Medicare dollars, that's okay. So your organizations are a bit of a pickle. They're going to be in keeping with some federal guidance and maybe at odds with the state, but federal supersedes. Is that correct, Brian?
We think it might, but we are concerned with some of the practical implications if we have conflict between a state law and what the federal rule from the government's healthcare agency, CMS, what that rule says, which that rule, as you said, has been upheld by the Supreme Court. I just want to go back and just say there may have been some health systems that took a more narrow approach to the exemption. I don't believe that any health system or any hospital was using, was rejecting exemption requests in a blanket format. I think what the federal law, what federal law allows is for kind of a case by case basis. And that sort of case by case basis would not be allowed under the state legislation. And we think that is important to retain that ability. And so, you know, fundamentally, I think we support the chamber. The chambers have great leadership on this issue. You know, there's a fundamental principle, I think, of businesses and private entities being able to set their own policies to protect workers. I do worry a little bit about the messaging and what it sends. We don't want to discourage businesses. We need more vaccination to emerge from this. And we don't want to have two sets of exemptions. But for us, there's even an additional, as I said, practical element. If we are out of compliance with what has now been upheld by the Supreme Court because of a state law, we could be at risk of losing all Medicaid and Medicare funding, which for most hospitals is the vast majority of their funding. And that's a scary prospect. Now, I'm not an attorney. I know there is one on the panel. I do think some people believe that ultimately that rule, the federal rule, would trump a state law. But we are crying out for certainty. The pandemic has had so many ups and downs, twists and turns, even with just vaccination policy. We just want to proceed and ask that we not have something in state law that opens us up to more litigation or just really more confusion.
Well, Matt, I mean, even though your bill passed out of the House overwhelmingly, and in fact, it has, I think, 55 other co-sponsors or co-authors besides you. So sailed out of that doesn't mean necessarily it's going to become law. Senate seems to have some reservations. The governor certainly has not ruled out a veto even. He's worried about the impact on economic development. This is an at-will state. Hoosiers pride themselves on not having a lot of handcuffs on employers. That's what they use it as an inducement. How do you answer the concern that this would affect our ability to be the kind of state that employers, large employers, want to move to?
John, you're right in the fact that I think, you know, and I began conversations with the Senate. I mean, there are probably some parts of this that need to be adjusted yet based on some of the Supreme Court rulings. But I think that if we just want to talk about the impact on economic development, I think there's two things I want to bring out. One is, I think the comment was made, that we're, it discourages the vaccine. And I think if we're hinging our economic development on a vaccine or not a vaccine, the people I've talked to looking for jobs aren't necessarily looking for where I can get it or not get it. Like I said, we're 13 months into a vaccine. If it's taking you 13 months to decide if you think you should get this, I think you've already made that decision. So right now, I think what I'm looking at is that from an economic standpoint is we had employment issues prior to this. I had, you're talking about limitations on hours. I had a local restaurant that's cutting their hours. It had nothing to do with people being out on COVID. It's just there's not a workforce out there. And so I guess the this talking about economic development and workforce is this balance between, you know, we were testimony 1,900 nurses on the 1003 committee, 1,900 nurses short, and then we see healthcare systems firing nurses. I'm trying to balance this from a pure economic standpoint is how are we letting people off? We're firing people over a standard I've taken of the employer, while at the same time coming down here and saying, and now we're short of staff. And that's where I'm trying to find that balance of saying from an economic, pure economic standpoint, is why are you bailing your staff?
Brian, is this an economic issue or is that missing the mark, do you think?
Well, I think you have to go back to the testimony we heard on this bill from a doctor who said hospitals and businesses had already made the cost-benefit analysis of letting those folks go who refused to get vaccinated. And I think that's where the Chamber and the Hospital Association are coming in. Or these businesses are in the best position to decide what the cost-benefit analysis is for them. They've made those decisions. We're not talking about very many employers here. This bill is mainly aimed at the Hospital Association. It's unfortunate they're doing everything they can through this crisis to keep people safe. And I hope that at least those portions of the bill will come out.
thank you very much, all of you, for sharing your insights. Obviously, it's good to have a rational discussion where all the sides can be aired. I appreciate it. Again, my guests have been Republican Representative Matt Lehman of Bern, Democratic Representative Ryan Hatfield of Evansville, Kevin Brenniger, President and CEO of the Indiana Chamber of Commerce, and Brian Tabor, President of the Indiana Hospital Association. And time now for our weekly conversation with Indiana Lawmakers News analyst Ed Feigenbaum, publisher of Indiana Legislative Insight, part of Hannah News Service. Ed, what stood out to you about the roundtable?
Well, the roundtable was quite informative, and I think a lot more informative and accurate than a lot of the debate that we saw on the floor of the House during the third reading debate on this. And one thing that really struck me from the debate on the floor was a lot of misinformation, both about the vaccines, the vaccination policies, the efficacy of things, and the Supreme Court ruling. And I think that you know, everybody's minds were made up going into that debate, so it really didn't matter in terms of the vote. But I think in terms of how the public viewed things, it was a little bit sketchy at times. And I think what also struck me about that debate was the amendments that didn't get offered. And I think that there was a lot of discussion within the House Republican caucus about just what was going to be okay to bring to the floor, and some of the amendments that dealt with unemployment compensation, that dealt with criminalization, with extension of the no vaccine mandates that were not offered, were indicative of just how split the caucus was on some of these issues.
And if the caucus is split, certainly the Republicans in the General Assembly as a whole are split. We mentioned this may have tougher going in the Senate. How does this end up?
Right. And I think that came across in the roundtable, and the Senate's already passed just the first half of the bill. And there were two different amendments in the House that would have done the same thing. One said, let's just dump the amendments that would stop the emergency. And then the other said, let's keep the emergency provisions like the Senate did and dump everything else that dealt with the vaccine mandate. I think the Senate's going to be a lot more tempered and temperate about this. I think that this is going to end up being a lot less broad than the House version when all things are said and done and the governor enters the debate.
If this version showed up on the governor's desk, would he veto it?
I'm not sure that he'd veto it, but I know that he wouldn't be very happy about it. It might be something that he'd allow to become law without a signature. I think understanding that a veto could be overridden with just a simple majority. He also has to be concerned about the grassroots, the people of Indiana who really do stand strong for individual liberties and don't like mandates in general. But at the same time, the optics are a little bit difficult. You know, we saw this debate happen during a week with some records that were set for hospitalization numbers and some near records for total numbers of cases. It's just a real tough issue to debate when you've got that going on in reality.
All right, Ed. Thanks, as always, for your insight. Much appreciated. Who should have the biggest say in what Hoosier school children are taught? Parents, teachers, school boards, or the General Assembly? On the next Indiana Lawmakers. You can access live streaming coverage of the General Assembly on the Internet as well. And remember, you can get our show on demand from Xfinity. Well, that concludes another edition of Indiana Lawmakers. I'm John Chuanis, and on behalf of WFYI Public Media and Indiana's other public broadcasting stations, I thank you for joining us, and I invite you to visit WFYI.org for more State House news. Until next week, take care.